It's getting near to Christmas, and there's a whole load of things on. So it's great that so many of you have come. And I don't want anybody to miss it who would really like to have been here. So, and if there's anything that you hear tonight you're not quite sure of, then you can go back onto the church website and download it and listen to it and go back over what Paul said. I hope that you're all tooled up with your iambic pentameters and your stanzas and things, because tonight promises to be a real adventure. We've never done poetry at any of our Advent or Lent courses before. So having somebody who's willing to come along and is excited to do poetry is brilliant. So Paul, thank you very much indeed for coming tonight. Paul and I were talking about poetry earlier on, and of course talking about how poetry is so much born out of experience. So to be able to enter into poems which speak about Christmas and Advent and religious fervour and excitement and church, it's great, because it'll open up not just the thoughts of the writers but our own feelings as well, and most of all, of course, Paul, hearing from you. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Charlie, and I want to thank indeed Charlie and the team. Can you hear me all right? Is this microphone okay? It's a bit too near, is it? Is that better? Like that? Can you hear that okay? I want to thank Charlie and the team for allowing me to occupy this Advent slot. It's an extraordinary pleasure for me to do this. It's both a self-indulgent and slightly intimidating pleasure. Self-indulgent because ever since I did O-level English literature, which was getting on for 50 years ago now, I've always loved poetry. Poetry is something which most people who love it tend to do it in private. They don't actually recite poetry very much. They don't quote it. They don't share it in public. For me to have this captive, and I must say, charmingly large audience here today, so that I can recite some of my favourite poems to you and hear what you say about them, well, that's a bit like Sue Lawley inviting you onto Desert Island Discs. So the first thing is great pleasure. But the second, I think, is slightly intimidating as well, because here I am standing on this same podium as the Bishop of St. Albans, Christopher Herbert, last week. Who could follow the Bishop of St. Albans? Well, I mean, nobody could follow the Bishop of St. Albans. But then after me, we've got Charlie and Sam, all clergy. And here is this layman, this self-styled prof, coming and talking to you about holy things. Well, I have to say immediately that I occupy no moral high ground here at all. The only thing is a little podium up here, but there's no high moral ground for me at all, and I'm not going to be preaching to you today. Yes, I am going to be talking in the broadest sense about poetry, or three chosen poems, and God, but there's going to be a lot more about poetry, and a lot less, I'm afraid, about God, about whom I am not qualified to speak in any serious way. So I've chosen today three poems, and they're all very different poems. The first is by Philip Larkin, an atheist, called Church Going. It's, I think, one of the last in the thing, Church Going. And it's written in the early 1950s. The second poem, which I shall come to in that order, is T.S. Eliot's The Journey of the Magi, a more familiar poem, perhaps, to some of you, written after his conversion to High Church Anglicanism in the early 1930s. And finally, a poem which probably won't be known to you at all, called The Burning Babe by Robert Southwell, an impassioned English Jesuit and martyr who was martyred at Tyburn in 1595. So, a very mixed bag of poems here. And what have they got to do with Advent? Well, there are two of them, the Magi and the Southwell, that do deal with Jesus, with the birth of Jesus, with the incarnation. But the first one, Church Going, is, I'm afraid, a piece of pure self-indulgence. It's about churches, old churches, things that I spend most of my life thinking about and pondering upon. And that's why I've included it. I suppose, however, if there was one common factor that unites all these three poems, when I look back on them now, unconsciously I chose them, one common factor is that they're all a bit tough. They're all a bit hard, not to understand, but hard in their message. The feel-good factor is not very high in these poems. I'm sorry for that. I didn't mean that to be so, but it's not. They deal with, in order, alienation, pessimism, doubt, discomfort, frustration, guilt, and sin. Yes, not cheerful events. But then, I don't know about you, but I don't think Advent is really a very cheerful period of the liturgical year. It's a period when the evenings are getting darker and darker, when we're increasingly worried about Christmas, at least the female members of this audience probably are, and where everything is actually beginning to get a bit colder and a bit more difficult. We're feeling tired, at least my colleagues are, at the end of a long term of teaching and administering. Advent, in a way, is a little bit like Lent, I feel. It's a period of preparation, the one for, of course, the birth of Christ, and the other for his death, his passion, and his resurrection. Both those two events, the incarnation and the resurrection, are, as we saw from Bishop Christopher's talk last week, folded together often into a single moment, their connections seen closely between themselves. They are both the beginning and the end of Christ's life, but they are, in a sense, part of a whole. So I think there is something sad about these Advent poems. But then the great thing about poetry, perhaps that's why I want to talk to you about poetry today and hear your responses, is that they take our sadnesses, our individual frustrations, our difficulties, our pains, our tragedies. They take that poetry, great poetry does, and it gives, through its literal and beautiful language, those individual sorrows, those ordinary mundane difficulties, a universal power and beauty. We can read poetry and say, my God, yes, he felt that too. I'm not alone here. And I'm not alone because I'm also in a language of supreme beauty and careful craftsmanship. This is the best kind of language. And we live in a world of such debased and corrupt language, from tabloids to politicians to generals, that to confront poetry as, put it in a cliche form, the flaming sword of truth is, whatever the content of the poems, something consoling and beautiful. And it's something which anybody can learn literally by heart at any time, and they can stand, as I do, in the rainy bus queues and remember things like what we're going to be talking about today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read or recite the poem first, straight through. Then I'm going to try and pick it apart, and then I'm going to ask you what you think of that poem. And then I'm going to go on to the next one. And if I'm too long, I will stop. So, let's start with Philip Larkin. Church going. You've got it in your things, and it's always sometimes quite good to follow it as I say it, because you can get a handle on it better if you read it, at least I do anyway. Here we go then. Once I'm sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church. Mattings, seats, stones, and little books. Sprawlings of flowers cut for Sunday, brownish now. Some brass and stuff up at the holy end. The small, neat organ. And that tense, musty, unignorable silence brood God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the front. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new, cleaned or restored. Someone would know, I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring, large-scale verses and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book, donate an Irish sixpence, reflect the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did. In fact, I often do, and always end, much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for, wondering too, when churches fall completely out of use, what we will turn them into. If we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment, plate and picks in locked cases, and let the rest rent-free to rain and sheep? Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or after dark will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some kind or other will go on in games, in riddles, seemingly at random. But superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, bramble, buttress, sky. A shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rood lofts are. Some ruin bibber, randy for antique. Or Christmas addict, counting on a whiff of gowns and bands and organ pipes and myrrh. Or will he be my representative, bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub, because it held, unspilled, so long and equably, what since is found only in separation, marriage, birth, death, and thoughts of these, for which was built this special shell. For though I've no idea what this accoutred frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house, on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized, and robed as destinies. And that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising in himself a hunger to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which they once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round. Now that's a bleak poem. It's the bleakest of all. It's very tough indeed. But there is in the end, because of the toughness, an irreducible core of high seriousness. It's a poem in a sense about a journey in which an atheistic observer, who clearly loves churches, faces in a sense what he thinks to be the reality of them, and tries to push his way through to the irreducible core of truth that these churches stand for. So it's a journey of discovery, but it's also a journey through Larkin's persona, and I mean persona in the definite sense. Larkin actually is presenting himself in this poem in a number of poses. The initial poses are ones of the cynical outsider, but at the end, we get to the real Larkin. It's a journey from a rather poserish sort of facade, a carapace, to the very heart of the man. What was Larkin like? Well, there's a picture of him there. I wish I had a photograph. Does he look like a poet? No, he doesn't really, does he? I mean, he looks more like a bank clerk or an insurance agent or an accountant or an actuary. He looks like somebody who leads a very correct, proper and useful life. And in fact, he wasn't those things, but he was something very similar. He was a librarian. He was a librarian of the University Library of Hull. And he remained there all his life, working as a librarian, with what he called the toad work sitting on his shoulders. And yet, he was one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. He was famed worldwide. He was lauded in London. He had smart friends like Kingsley Amis. He could have joined the London cultural metropolitan chic, but he didn't. He hid himself away behind the book stacks of a provincial university. And that disguise was deliberate. It was a way of keeping at bay the world outside in order to preserve intact, beneath this crustaceous shell, his own very powerful, very searching sensitivity. And in a sense, this poem is about breaking down that shell. The first stanza immediately tells us of that. Once I'm sure there's nothing going on, I step inside. He doesn't want to go into a church where there's anything happening in it. Oh no, he's not a member of the congregation. He's a deliberate outsider. I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church. So he goes to churches, but it's the pose of a rather bored and detached observer. Another church. And then a brilliant analysis of what we all feel when we go into churches first. Those little things that catch our attention almost arbitrarily. Mattings, seats, stones, little books. That's all the little prayer books, little books, hymn books. And then this brilliant image, sprawlings of flowers, cut for Sunday, brownish now. It's a seedy church. It's slightly going off colour. Brownish now. The small, neat organ. Then he has to pull all these little images together. And he does it brilliantly with smell, which unites them all. And that tense and silence, that tense, musty, unignorable silence, brood. And then he says something slightly sort of facetious. God knows how long. But he uses the word God deliberately because he wants to be deliberately iconoclastic here. God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips. Doesn't that date him? Who has cycle clips now? He takes off his cycle clips. He obviously cycles from church to church, which is what a thing people did in the 1950s and 60s. I still used to do it. It was lovely. Now, this is, having described the church, he now actually talks about what he does inside it. And what he does inside this church is like a naughty boy. He's just posing as a naughty boy. I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence. So he does feel a sort of reverence, but it's awkward. I run my hand around the font. That's perfect, because you go in a church at the West End, and the font is almost certainly the first thing you come to. And you see its sculpture, and you want to run your hand around to feel the sculpture. Run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new. Cleaned or restored? Some of them know I don't. You know, he's posing that he doesn't know anything about this church. Later on, you know that he does know about churches. Mounting the lectern, this is really the naughty boy, he mounts the lectern and he starts to read the verses. But I'm afraid, you know, he reads them too loudly. And the echoes snigger briefly, like little naughty boys in the corner of the school, you know, playground, sniggering, snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book. Donate an Irish sixpence. Remember we used to do that in collections? Donate an Irish sixpence. Reflect the place was not worth stopping for. Now that could be the end of that poem. Just a detached, cynical, pessimistic observer. But now, the key moment of this poem, the turning point of it is, yet stop I did. Ah! The first layer of the onion is peeled open, and we're now on the journey into the centre of Larkin's sensibility. Yet stop I did. In fact, I often do. Ah! So he goes to lots of churches, and always end much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for, wondering too, and now we move out from this church into a long meditation about the nature of churches and what's going to happen to them in the future. Highly topical subjects for the Church of England today. Wondering too, when churches fall completely out of use, what we will turn them into. If we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, isn't that brilliant? Chronically, you say someone's got a chronic illness. This is like a kind of illness that these churches are chronically on show. They're parchment, plate, and picks. Brilliant alliteration. Picks in locked cases. Now, picks, what is a picks? It's a little container, little tabernacle for the consecrated host. This man who pretends that he knows nothing about churches, that calls the brass and stuff up at the holy end instead of the choir, knows the word picks. He certainly knows a lot more about churches than he's letting on about. In locked cases, and let the rest rent free to rain and sheep. Ruins, in other words. Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? And now we go into something like the superstition that might come at the end of a post-Christian era. Unlucky places. Would dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or see ghosts? Power of some kind or another will go on. He says, even after Christianity, these churches are like little nuclear power stations of divine radiation, some kind of spiritual radiation, which the Christian church will have left behind, but it will still go on in games, in riddles, seemingly at random. Riddles, a little like children's riddles and games and nursery rhymes, that beneath the surface of the words of those children's rhymes, there are these deep meanings which go back to the moments when the rhymes were created, like ring a ring of roses, we all fall down. That goes back to the plague of 1668. In other words, somehow these meanings, original meanings, will remain there, but they'll be sort of in riddles, seemingly at random. But, and this is even worse, he goes further. But even superstition will die. Superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? A brilliant image. Grass, weedy pavement, bramble, buttress, sky. It's a brilliant image of ruins. And then the wonderful way he turns it. A shape less recognizable each week. A purpose more obscure. That goes to my heart, because of course, for some of us, we're living in a culture, actually, in which Christian truth is disappearing behind us at a tremendous reverse rate. I'll give you one example of this. I teach, you know, art history at London University, and I interview A-level students for places at the Courtauld Institute. There was one girl who'd done religious studies. She came for an interview. I thought, good, I'll show her a religious image, a very simple image, Piero della Francesca's wonderful resurrection of Christ from Borgo San Sepolcro, splendid figure standing there. So I put it to her and I said, what's that? Thinking, this is going to be great. Well, she said, looks like a man, a bit wounded. He seems to be coming out of what looks like a sort of box or something. I'm not quite certain. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, yes, yes, God. Is it the Ascension?
No, I said, but you're getting a bit warm. Try again.
Oh, I don't really know. I said, it's the Resurrection. Oh, yes, yes, of course. I said, you're doing religious studies at A level. I said, and you don't frankly know what the Resurrection is? You can't recognise it? Oh, well, I said, what's your syllabus? Well, we said we do Hinduism, we do Buddhism, we do moral ethics studies, we do cosmological theories of the universe. Well, that's fascinating. But they don't actually know the brass tacks of their own culture, a culture which is rapidly disappearing from us. Unless we hold on to it, we will lose it. So a shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure, goes right to the heart of this problem. And then, even closer to Larkin, we say, I wonder who will be the very last, to seek this place for what it was. And then naughty old Larkin has a jab at all those people he can't bear. For example, the antiquarians like me, one of the crew that jot and tab and know what rood lofts are, you know, the experts. And then he has a good go at the high church Anglicans, the people like John Betjeman, you know, who love the smells and the bells, you know. Or some ruin bibber, randy for antique, isn't that brilliant? Lusting after the past. Or, what was the other one? I can't remember. Ruin bibber, randy for antique, or Christmas addict. That's the smells and bells, counting on a whiff. Brilliant, that whiff, because of course high church Anglicans love incense, a whiff of downs and bands and organ pipes and myrrh. I don't want to criticise them anyway, but this is Larkin being naughty. You know, he's being a naughty schoolboy. Or will he be my representative? Bored. Well, he's not really bored. He's definitely not bored.
uninformed, he's not really uninformed. Knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, that's grim. Christianity for him is the dregs at the bottom of the bottle, the silt at the bottom of the wave. And it's not only, it's not even contained within the church now, it's dispersed like ashes thrown over a cemetery. Dispersed, yet, and here's one of the most moving parts of the poem, yet tending in the sense of moving, but also in the sense of caring for, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub. Brilliant, suburb scrub. It's not a pretty little church with a lych gate and the roses over it. It's a little boring church in the suburbs, a bit like the scrubland, those awful weeds growing in the sort of interstices between the countryside and the town. Through suburb scrub, because it held, unspilled, so it hasn't spilt yet, it's still there, unspilled, so long and equably beautiful, equally balanced, so long and equably, what since is found only in separation. And what's found only in separation now? Marriage, birth, death, the actual great chapters of our life, for which was built this special shell. For though I've no idea what this accoutred frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. That's the bottom of it. He wants to stand in silence in this modest, boring little church, but he finds it deeply moving, and he says so with a sort of stoical simplicity. It pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized, and robed as destinies. Now, that's a very Durkheimian and rather sociological and anthropological view of religion. The religion actually takes all our basic animal compulsions and elevates them. They meet together, and they are robed liturgically as if all our compulsions are destinies. Well, we believe that they are. We believe that our life does have a plot and a meaning and a direction, of course. But Larkin has to, so to speak, register that that's a matter of belief, not a matter of fact. And that much, he says, never can be obsolete. So at last, we've got something we can cling on to, something eternal from this little church, that someone will forever be surprising in himself a hunger to be more serious and gravitating with it to this ground, which they once heard was proper to grow wise in. The church is an embodiment of wisdom. And then the last line, Larkin can't end on a note of serious, high moral purpose. Oh no, because he's an outsider, he has to put in a little dig at the end. If only that so many dead lie round. What does that mean? That if you're dead, you're more wise? Or that if you can be wiser by hanging around in the cemetery around the church? That's not at all clear. He puts that in just a kind of, as a little passing joke, a little passing kind of cynical whiff at the end of this statement of high purpose. And that makes me cross with him. I get angry with Larkin because he's a poser, because he's kind of always teetering on the edge of the swimming pool. He's never jumping in. He's never actually, you know, coming to grips with reality. He's standing there, and it's easy to stand there, and he's mocking. But at least he's taken us through to the truth. That's what he really believes. And that's what I love about this poem. All these poems, they're truthful. Well, that's the tough one. What do you think? I mean, you don't have to ask questions. We can go on to the next one if you like. But I just feel, you know, this is, I'm throwing all this at you. And you might think, is it a bit too complicated, all this? Yeah. Go on. Great. Next one, T.S. Eliot. Perhaps we're having the end, we'll have this question. T.S. Eliot, The Journey of the Magi. You got that in your thing? A cold coming we had of it. Just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep, the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out, and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile, and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears saying that this was all folly. Then, at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness and three trees on the low sky. And an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at the open door, dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information. So we continued and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember. And I would do it again. But set down this. Set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to these places, our kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. Now, that's shorter than the Larkin, you'll be pleased to see, and it's equally clearly written, written with a great clarity and detachment. The first thing that probably strikes you is that there's not a single mention of that second chapter in Matthew, which, as the bishop told us last week, was the only source in the New Testament for the journey of the Magi. No dream in which the Magi were warned to return to their kingdoms by a different route. No gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And, of course, no Star of Bethlehem. Instead, bizarrely, Eliot's text for this poem is, as you can see, the first lines of the poem, which are in quotation marks. And this, in fact, is Eliot's poetical version of an extremely obscure sermon preached by Bishop Lancelot Andrews, Bishop of Winchester, sometime in the late 16th or perhaps early 17th century. Preached on the day of the Feast of the Epiphany of the 6th of January. And I'll read you an extract from the book 10 20th Century Poets, which I studied for my O-level English all those years ago. Here's Andrews. It was no summer progress. A cold coming they had of it at this time of the year. Just the worst time of the year to take a journey, and especially a long journey in. The ways deep, the weather sharp, the days short, the sun farthest off, in solstitio brumali, the very dead of winter. That's extraordinarily like, of course, the quotation at the top. Why does Eliot not go to the New Testament? Why does he go to this bishop? Because the bishop, as opposed to the New Testament, told Eliot, or suggested to Eliot, two things which the New Testament never did. It first of all dealt this sermon with what it must have actually been like for the Magi to travel from their eastern kingdoms to Bethlehem, And secondly, it dealt with the response, the possible response of the Magi to this earth-shattering, life-changing encounter with God made man, with God as a baby. That's what interested Eliot. Now, we're dealing here, in a sense, with two types of truth, what I might call biblical truth and historical truth. The bishop quite rightly said to us last week, when he talked about the question of biblical truth, he said, it doesn't really matter whether we think there really were the three magi that journeyed to Bethlehem and arrived on the 6th of January in the year 1 or 0 AD. And I agree with him. What matters about that remarkable story is not so much the beautiful poetic and magical narrative of that story. It's the truths that the story opens portals for us into. And what are those truths? To me, utterly convincing truths. That if God, omniscient and eternal, becomes a small baby in our time and space, then it is quite proper that all the kingdoms of the earth, as represented by the three magi, should come to venerate him, and that the heavens, as well as the earth, in the form of the stars and the constellations, should also, in a sense, conspire in that worship. Heaven and earth should come together at this earth-shattering moment where our lives at last have meaning. If we don't believe in that, if we don't believe in that magical parable, then our Christmases are forever to be impoverished. But Eliot wasn't interested in that magical parable. It was too familiar to him. He wanted to explore historical truth. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the Magi left documents or journals, that we have historical evidence for the Magi. No, but on the other hand, we know that history, yes, history is a foreign country, as L.P. Hartley said, but it is a country which we can inhabit. And we do that partly by historical documents from the past, but partly by the exercise of the historical imagination. We can actually step into the shoes of people in the past because they were like us. There's a kinship with us. They felt frustration, anger, doubt, disbelief, hope, as we do. So we can bridge the centuries and the millennia through the exercise of our proper, sympathetic, historical imagination. And that's what Lancelot Andrews was doing. And that's what Eliot was doing. It was, in a sense, leaping across time. Time fascinated T.S. Eliot. If we might say landscape was the principal source of inspiration for English poets in the late 18th and 19th centuries, time was the continual obsession of T.S. Eliot in his poetry. Poetry before he was converted to Christianity, to Anglicanism, and afterwards. Yes, this poem is about historical time in that sense, but it's also about time in two other ways. Time as tradition and time as memory. Eliot was a true conservative, despite the fact that he was one of the great founders, revolutionary founders, of the modern movement of 20th century poetry. He believed that it was the duty of the historian and the poet to keep alive the treasures of European and world literature, to use those great examples of literature in his and their own poems, and then made fruitful to pass that great treasury on to future generations. Eliot was fascinated by what the past could tell us now. In one of his greatest poems, Little Gidding, part of the Four Quartets, he says that the language of the dead is tongued with fire beyond the language of the living. We are the guardians of memory, says Eliot, and it is our duty to preserve our inheritance. A bit like Larkin, saying that everything is disappearing into the past. We have to clutch it, we have to hold it. Hence, Eliot's poems, before and after his conversion, are full of extremely complex quotations, some with quotation marks, some without, from the whole gamut of Western and Eastern literature, from Homer and Virgil to the Upanishads to Milton and Shakespeare, all woven seamlessly into the texture of Eliot's own poetry, just as Lancelot Andrews' text was. We read Eliot, but we also read behind Eliot the greatness of Western European literature. And thirdly, there's another aspect of time here, and that is of memory. The poem is all about memory. It's about an old king looking back on the greatest, the most revelatory event of his life. And the first two stanzas, the first two-thirds of the poem, are in fact a description of what it was like at that time to go through those events, written with all the vividness of an eyewitness. It's written in the first-person tense, as grammarians call it, I and we, not the third person, not they or she or he. No, it's I, we did that. And it's a brilliantly evocative and vivid description. But the last part of the poem, all this was a long time ago, I remember, he says, is, of course, him standing back and looking at those vivid events from the perspective of his own day. Wordsworth said that the greatest poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility, and that's what this poem is. It's an original charge of powerful events, then, so to speak, detached and given their proper meaning in the hindsight of his life. And it's so much like our own lives, isn't it? We see sometimes events that aren't particularly important at the time, but then suddenly when we look back at them, we see that they're turning points in our life. Other great events, which we think are terribly important, turn out to have less importance. Eliot therefore speaks of the power of memory to recall and to reflect upon those events. And he speaks in a language of fastidious and stoical clarity and detachment. No hyperbole, no high-flown language here. Eliot is that generation of post-First World War poets who had seen language corrupted in the late Edwardian era by the jingoism that led to the First World War, by the pseudo-sentimentality of late Victorian love poetry, and to that soggy tradition. Eliot brought a great simplicity of language because after the First World War, everything had changed. English society, English literature, English poetry. A new, straight, simple, truthful language had to be forged. And that's the language that Eliot uses. It never seems to go beyond the kind of fastidious detachment, but when it does, my gosh, it grips the heart, because in the contrast between the iciness of the narrative and the vividness of the real feelings, you feel you are again, as with Larkin, in the presence of truth. So let's go through this in little detail. It won't take so long this time. But there we've got the quotation at the top. That's fine. No problem about that. We don't want to go any further than that. Okay, so now, then Eliot starts. And he starts brilliantly with camels, because that's exactly what was the problem with this journey. Camels. Has anybody ridden a camel? I have never ridden a camel, and I have no desire to ride a camel. They are the most ungainly, stubborn, difficult animals. They may be all right in a tropical climate, semi-tropical like Egypt, but in winter, journeying over high uplands to Bethlehem, disastrous. So the camels galled. That's a brilliant word. Gall is in fact a noun. You can't have a verb, galled. It's a noun. It's that sort of stuff that comes from the gallbladder, that sort of viscous and horrible liquid that you feel when you have indigestion. You know, it comes right up the stomach. Galled translates that noun, an object, into a verb, into something active. Brilliant. Galled. Sore-footed. Yes, of course they're sore-footed because they want snow to go through these camels. One of Eliot's best words now, refractory. Ooh, you have to get your mouth around that, refractory. What does it mean? It means obstinate, stubborn, difficult. But Eliot wants that word refractory because it's very difficult to say. It's all legs and arms and elbows, refractory with its consonants. It brilliantly sums up what those camels are as they try to get up and get down on their ungainly legs. Sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. Oh, gosh, they're that camel. camel goes again on the snow. And then, if you think that Eliot can be cool, yes, he can. But suddenly, he can pull out from this cool, detached language a lyrical line or two which is worthy of Shakespeare, and so particular here. There were times we regretted. Listen to the sibilant S's here. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. The sensuality of that. Oh, what are we here on this terrible journey when we could be back in our marvellous palaces with terraces in the summertime with these gorgeous girls bringing us sherbet. Sherbet is a summer drink to cool you. So at the start of that thing we have summer palaces, and at the end of that episode we have sherbet, both beginning and end suggesting summer. A little brief vision of what they'd left behind. And then grumpy old man Magus begins, you know, a catalogue of woes. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters. It's just me being a grumble old man, you know. Joni will say that, you know. I get all my high horse of grumpy old man, you know. And then the lack of fires and lack of shelters, and the night fires going on, the lack of shelters and how does it go on? Oh yes, and the city's hostile and the town's unfriendly and the village is dirty and charging high prices. Can you imagine these grand, sophisticated, intellectual princes from the East? Oh, my dear, those dreadful villages. So dirty and so expensive, too. Dirty and expensive. A hard time we had of it, he says. It's as if he wants to end that catalogue of woes. But he doesn't quite, because there's something very interesting happening. You weren't to know that this was really the godchild? You weren't to know that your journey was even going to end with a meeting with this extraordinary baby. You'd left behind your sophisticated culture of the East. You'd left behind your little girls with sherbet, and there you were with these flipping camel men cursing and grumbling. And what was it all for? It could be a complete disaster. That's psychologically brilliant. And then the atmosphere changes dramatically in the second stanza. Then at dawn, dawn. Dawn is always a good moment, a good start, a new dawn. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley. Wow, different from all those extremes up with the camels in the mountains. Temperate valley, wet, smelling of vegetation, below the snow line. But we know that that's dangerous. With a running stream. Now, that's always a sign of paradise. The rivers of paradise, the running stream of purification. And a watermill beating the darkness. And three trees on the low sky. Now, what we have is a series of snapshots of memory. The three trees on the low sky. The horse riding away. All those things. The tavern with the vine leaves. The men at the open door dicing for pieces of silver. It's extraordinary. This is how memory actually works. It works as a series of images which come up from the unconscious. It's quite arbitrarily. You know, I remember happy memories of my grandparents, but I don't remember any sequence of conversation I had with them. I don't even remember many events that happened with them. But I remember extremely vividly stills in my mind, as if they were photographs. My grandmother bending over the stove. My grandfather in his garden, proudly showing me his tomatoes from his greenhouse. My grandmother and grandfather sitting in the shade of their garden, having afternoon tea. These things I remember like stills, as if my memory is taking a photograph. And this is what Eliot says of this too. Why, for all of us, out of all that we've heard, seen, felt in a lifetime, do certain images recur, charged with emotion rather than others? The song of one bird, the leap of one fish, at a particular place and time. Six ruffians seen through an open window, playing cards at night at a small French railway junction where there was a water mill. That experience is, so to speak, appearing in this poem, and it's exemplifying precisely the principle that Eliot is saying. We have a series of stills here of that journey. But they're not just ordinary stills, are they? they're deeply symbolic stills. We are now in a symbolic landscape, the landscape, the temperate landscape of paradise. We are literally getting warmer, warmer to the confrontation with the Christ child. So what are these symbolic references? Well, the three trees on the low sky, that must be the three crosses of Christ and the two and the two thieves. Then again, the old white horse, I'm not sure about that. That's a tricky one. People think it might be the horse of the apocalypse. I think it might be a horse you see from a train that Eliot was talking about. You know, horses run away from trains when you go by. But now when we get to the tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, vine leaves, grapes, red grapes, they're always associated with Eucharistic symbolism. Eliot would have known very well the late medieval and counter-reformation image of the suffering Christ in the wine press, his body being pressed downwards so that his dripping blood from his body merges with the grapes that he is treading underfoot, and the Eucharistic wine transubstantiated, coming out of the wine press. So vine leaves are obviously to do with Christ's passion. And then six hands at the open door, dicing for pieces of silver. Well, the dicing is probably the Roman soldiers that diced at the foot of the cross for Christ's garments, and the pieces of silver are obviously the 30 pieces of silver that Judas betrayed Christ with. Kicking the empty wineskins, it's an image of Christ's empty blood, I think his empty body being kicked and defiled by his executioners. We must be careful about this symbolism, but there is no doubt that it is a passion symbolism. And that is so interesting, that these magi are coming towards the Christ child, but in a landscape that is reminding us of the end of Christ's life, of his passion. Just as we saw with images of Bishop Christopher last week, with actually images of his tomb next to his cradle in the stable. And then we continue with the narrative. He says, yes, he says, we journeyed on, and then at evening we came, not a moment too soon, to the place, finding the place. And then one of the great understatements of English literature, it was, you may say, satisfactory. Oh, I could shake at first that magus. What do you mean, you may say satisfactory? Haven't you got anything to say about this, I would say to him? Don't you think that this is important? Well, of course, in a way, he can't say anything, can he? Because this is an event so astonishing, so powerful. Meeting, actually, God made man, made a baby. What can you say to something like that? This is a transcendent experience of such power and authority that words simply do not run here. I think of that wonderful moment in Cardinal Newman's Dream of Gerontius, set to music by Edward Elgar, where the soul of Gerontius is assumed into heaven and stands before the judgment seat, knowing that he will go to heaven. Well, what would I have done if I had stood in front of God's judgment seat? I would have said, I'm sure, oh, God, thank you so much for having me. I'm really, it was a close-run thing. I can't believe that I'm here, but thank you for giving me a place. I'm just so grateful to you. Thank you. Oh, and there's Auntie Ada there, over there. How lovely to see you. And there's my grandma. Oh, great to see you. Wonderful. You know, fantastic. I'll be with you in a minute. This is wonderful, you know. Or, oh, I wasn't expecting to see you here. Okay. You there. But no, what does Gerontius say when he stands in front of the throne of God at that awesome and transcendent moment? He says, take me away. It's just too much. So if the Magus had actually tried to say something about this event, it would have been immediately false. But he does say something about it later, because then he goes on to say that this was a long time ago and I would do it again. That's the ultimate test case. He would go through all that again as an old man because it was so important to him. But was this about birth? Yes, it was, of course. We had evidence and no doubt, he says in his rather forensic and policeman-like manner. Evidence and no doubt. But he'd seen birth and death. And it was in a way like death. Of course it was. We know this. You know, Christ said, in order to gain life, you must lose your life.
St. Paul said, didn't he? I can't remember in which of the epistles, but he said to us, you must die to the life of sin in order to be raised to Christ Jesus. But this shedding of old skins, old guilts, old habits, to confront the challenge of the new, of God's love, is incredibly painful, as we all know. It places great demands on us. Don't think that God's love is sentimental and easy. It isn't. So this is utterly consistent with the psychology of change and of conversion. And there he goes back to his kingdoms, but he's totally, all of them, alienated because they're in a different culture. They've lost their past culture. They've gained a new one, but it's a new one in, so to speak, in limbo. And that's why the last line actually says he would be glad of another death, which is his own death. For the first time, he uses a word about happiness, glad. Yeah, he's definitely glad. So that's that one. And now I think I've got another 5 minutes, have I? Charlie, 5 minutes? Okay, great. 10? Okay. Okay. I've rushed that one. Okay, oh, bless you, good. I've rushed that one a bit, but this one's easy. This one's very easy, but it's the most powerful of all. Robert Southwell was an English Jesuit. He was a Catholic, obviously, but he unfortunately, of course, lived in Elizabethan England. He was ordained a Jesuit in Rome. He studied in Dowie, amongst the Benedictines in the Low Countries. And then he was sent to England as a recusant priest, as a missionary, one of the most dangerous things that the Catholics could do. But as a Jesuit, of course, this was something that was central to his training. The Jesuits, as you probably know, were, in a sense, the sort of shock troops, the Royal Marines of theological orthodoxy, of the Counter-Reformation, of the Catholic Church. And they were sent to the really hard places. They were sent to convert the Chinese. They were sent to South America to suffer martyrdom under the Aztecs. And they were sent to Elizabethan England, where the Pope had ridiculously said, of course, that it was the duty of Catholics to overturn the monarchy, thus turning all Catholics into traitors. Well, he arrived as a young man in England, Robert Southwell. He was then captured, as most of these priests were. He was tortured virtually continually in the Tower of London for 2 to 3 years, and then he was hung, drawn, and quartered at Tyburn, that is Hyde Park Corner in London, in 1595. He was, in other words, a martyr, a Catholic martyr, going along with all the Protestant martyrs too, but he was a Catholic martyr. And one has to understand something of that impassioned commitment in this poem. So now, let's read this. As I, in hoary winter's night, stood shivering in the snow, surprised I was with sudden heat, which made my heart to glow, and lifting up a fearful eye to view what fire was near, a pretty babe, all burning bright, did in the air appear, who, scorched with excessive heat, such floods of tears did shed, as though his floods should quench his flames, which with his tears were bred. Alas, quoth he, but newly born in fiery heats I fry, yet none approach to warm their hearts or feel my fire. But I, my faultless breast, the furnace is, the fuel wounding thorns. Love is the fire, and sighs the smoke, the ashes, shames, and scorns. The fuel justice layeth on, and mercy blows the coals. The metal in this furnace wrought are men's defiled souls, for which, as now on fire I am, to work them to their good, so will I melt into a bath to wash them in my blood. With this he vanished out of sight and swiftly shrunk away, and straight I call it unto mind that it was Christmas Day. That's a toughie. You won't find many Christmas cards with the burning babe. You won't find the normal conventional view of Christmas as this image of horrific suffering undergone by an innocent Christ child and seen by a visionary Jesuit on a cold winter's night. Compared to the fastidious scholarly detachment of Eliot
and the slightly sort of cheeky cynicism and sort of greyness of Larkin, this poem has power and heat. It goes for the jugular. It's not a complicated poem. It's not intellectually sophisticated, like Eliot. It's not psychologically sophisticated, like Larkin. But it packs a punch of extraordinary strength. And yet, it's a vision. A vision which is so palpable, you can almost see it. You suspend your disbelief. And yet, if I was to come home to Joan and say, "Hi, darling, I've just come in from the cold, I've just come back from work, and I've seen this babe in the sky burning, and we've had this awful conversation about burning and so on, and death and guilt." And I see Joan would say, "Oh, okay, darling, you just sit down. Have you had your tablets today? Okay, you just sit down. I'll get you a cup of tea, and you just calm down a bit. You'll be all right." Yes, that's what we normally think about visions like this. But this poem persuades us that this vision is actually real. Now, not only is this vision extraordinarily real, it's extraordinarily, so to speak, physical. This is the babe, and the babe's body is being scorched with excessive heat, and the tears, in some awful sense, which should actually quench this heat, is actually, on the contrary, making it worse. And then the terrible instruments of torture which the poet announces, like justice, which is the fuel which lays on the fire. Mercy, which ought to be stopping the fire, is actually fanning it with bellows. There are the ashes, the shame, the scorns. There is Christ's wounding thorns. All these things go together as instruments of torture to make the poor baby's body the most painful experience you can imagine. It's intensely physical, this. And if you don't like that, perhaps you won't like also the idea that this actually makes a direct assault on your susceptibilities. It doesn't come at you from the side. It doesn't ingratiate itself to you. It faces you with the fact of human guilt. Not a fashionable word, guilt, today. We live in a post-Freudian world in which we explain guilt away as perhaps something that we've acquired from our mothers in the pram, or something that really we mustn't think about. We should have counselling. We should have compassionate care. Of course we should. But if we believe in a moral universe, and we do believe in a God-given moral universe, then there is evil and there is good. And if we believe that God has given us free will, and otherwise we are not human, then we actually can sin. And if we do sin, then there is the mechanism of guilt to remind us of that. Now, I don't want to stress this too much, but this is at the central part of this poem, and it's guilt rammed home to us, almost with brutal power. All this is extremely foreign to our religious culture, I think. Not to mine, because I'm a Catholic, or, you know, I was brought up as a Catholic. But I think to an Anglican, Protestant, and Methodist culture, this is very strange. It's strange to have religious truth presented so powerfully at us. Strange, too, to associate revolution or revelation with the human body in this way. Strange to think about biblical or divine truth in terms of intense visionary experience. But all this is typical of Catholic Counter-Reformation culture and particularly Jesuit spirituality. The Jesuits followed the exercises of their founder, St. Ignatius of Loyola, over a period of many weeks with great self-discipline. And part, in fact, most of their exercises was taking a passage of scripture and thinking about it in the most literal and physical sense, and then imagining that they, that Jesuit, was in that world, that event, and was in some sense influencing it, or was the recipient of it. We actually are part of Christ's suffering, as Robert Southwell's vision brilliantly and dramatically conveys to us. I remember when I was a small boy at my school, about 13 or 14, the Jesuits used to come down from Stonyhurst to give us retreats.
And I remember one Jesuit particularly who explained to us boys, we were all about 14, 15, that's all, what it was like actually to be crucified in the Roman world. He read us a doctor's report. How nails would have gone into a particular part of the hand, what nerves would have been activated by the nails in the feet of the hand, what effect of pain there would have been on crowns of thorns over Christ's skull, what particular nervous tissues were particularly intensely excruciating. And this the Jesuit told us about, I remember, for half an hour to three quarters of an hour. At the end of it, he said, "And this is what you have done." My God. In a sense, he was right. Yes, of course, Christ died for our sins. But us, little innocent boys of 14 or 15, it was the most direct assault on our susceptibilities. And it was totally inappropriate. Not for adults, not for Jesuits, but for us. And I remember in tears going to one of my dear urbane Benedictine teachers and saying, "I'm going to go to hell. I've caused Christ this terrible suffering. It's absolutely appalling. I know all about the nails. It's all me." And this dear Benedictine says, "Oh, dear boy," he said, "come sit down, come sit down." He put his arm round me. Can't do that nowadays. Boys on lower, but no. Put his arm round me. He said, "Don't worry, dear boy, don't worry." He said, "These Jesuits, he said, they're a little enthusiastic." He said, "God loves you, dear boy. God loves you. Just remember that God loves you." Yes, of course. It's the compassionate God that in the end we come back to for consolation and succor. But this is the poem which shows us the suffering and the guilt, which is part and parcel of Christ's salvation, and without which we would not be redeemed. Now, it's 9 o'clock, so it's time for me to end. Thank you.
Paul's lecturing in New York next week, so he's taken time out to come and spend it with us this evening. Aren't we privileged?
You've
got such a treasure of information. It really is inspiring. I've found it inspiring tonight, and I'm so pleased we've got it on tape. I think you ought to do DVDs.
Don't look at me. But you wouldn't sell my looks.
You'll be able to hear it again. And Paul, thank you once again. Thank you so much. I really don't want to do next week's now. I really, really don't want to do next week. Shall we just have a quick prayer before we go? Dearest Lord, we thank you so much for the insights which have been made clear to us tonight through this poetry. And we thank you, dear Lord, that you speak through so many different means, through pictures, through words. And thank you for Paul and his ability to make those words real to us so that we can learn more about you. Amen. Thanks for coming, everyone. Thank you.